May it please the court, Eileen Buckhalter, Deputy District Attorney, appearing on behalf of the people in this case. Your Honor, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I might. The people bring this appeal on a question of law after the trial court acquitted the defendant on the PALPO charge based on an affirmative defense instruction under the Colorado constitutional right to bear arms. The trial court found that all of the elements of the PALPO offense were proven beyond a reasonable doubt, but rejected the people's assertion that as an essential element of that affirmative defense, there has to be an imminent threat in order to invoke that affirmative defense. Defense counsel took the position at trial that there was no requirement for any imminent threat to the defendant's person or property in order for there to be the affirmative defense instruction. The trial court agreed with that argument, rejected the people's argument, and that is why the people are here today.
Didn't the trial court say that the people had not disproven the affirmative defense?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And isn't that somewhat of a different issue?
That is a different issue, Your Honor, but the issue we are bringing before the court today, if I might, is the issue of what are the essential elements of that affirmative defense. Our position is there has to be an imminent threat, based on the cases we've cited, in order for a convicted felon under our PALPO statute to assert the affirmative defense under the Constitution.
So are you saying there was insufficient evidence in the record to assert the affirmative defense in the first place? Because the trial court said you had failed to disprove it.
That's true, Your Honor, and the reason we're saying the trial court's ruling was erroneous was because of the trial court's erroneous understanding and application of what are the elements of the affirmative defense. We assert, and based on the trial court's findings, that had the proper elements been required for the affirmative defense, that the defendant would not have been acquitted.
And where do you find this element?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Where do you find the element?
Okay, there's People versus Barger, Your Honor, that we've cited, 1986 case where a panel of this court affirmed the trial court's exclusion of the affirmative defense and the instruction in a PALPO prosecution where the defendant asserted the constitutional right to bear arms. And in PALPO, in Barger, the court, in so affirming the trial court, did so because the defendant, the felon, had failed to show the presence of a threat at the time of the illegal possession. In that case, the defendant made an offer of proof. Well, I've had these run-ins with motorcycle gangs, and so I carry a gun because I have fear for my personal safety. We're talking about a convicted felon, Your Honor, not an average citizen. And the court found, this court, at least a panel of it, agreed with the trial court, saying that there wasn't the presence of an imminent threat. What happened was this felon was in a bar, had a gun, took the gun out, placed it on the bar, and off-duty officer saw it and arrested this defendant. And what's interesting about Barger, Your Honor, is the court in Barger relied on Ford, the very case the trial court relied on and defense relies on, to find that the affirmative defense was properly excluded.
Ms. Buckhalter, let me ask you a little bit about Barger, because yes, Barger relied on Ford.
Yes.
Okay, and my understanding in Barger is they said this is not an instance where you're defending your home. This is an instance where you're either defending person or property. They made that distinction in that
Barger,
case.
Yes.
Right. And I think you just said a little bit earlier that what Barger held was that you needed an imminent threat. And where in Barger did it say an imminent threat?
And I agree with the court. Mm-hmm. It said the presence of a threat in context. If you look at the context, and I apologize, that is the more precise language. Our position is the presence of a threat is actually a more stringent requirement than an imminent threat.
But now, did Barger discuss the elements of PAPO, or did it just make that statement in deciding that there was an insufficient offer of proof in that case?
Your Honor, and I think if I might go specifically here, because I think this is very crucial, Barger relied on Ford. And what it said was it stated that the court in Ford stated that the right to bear arms is limited to the defense of one's home, person, and property, and concluded that the statute may validly restrict or regulate the right to possess arms when that possession is not a constitutionally protected one. And in the next paragraph, it talks about the fact that this defendant chose to go to the bar, that there was no threat, i.e. in the bar, at the time of the illegal possession. And that's the core of our argument, Your Honor. That is why we would assert, and it makes sense just reading the case, that's why the Court of Appeals, a panel, not this panel, said not entitled to the affirmative defense, not entitled to the instruction. So Barger, and the interesting thing about that passage that I just referred to in Ford, that passage, if you look at, I believe it's the line or two just preceding, it may be the very preceding line, Ford refers to Blue. And Blue said that the PAPO statute is constitutional, that it does not abrogate a felon's right to possess, right to self-defense, and that the reason it doesn't is because PAPO has to be read in peri materia with the choice of evil statute, and more particularly that part of the choice of evil statute that decriminalizes the possession if it is necessary to avoid an imminent injury. We think that language parallels the language of the present threat in Barger.
Isn't that argument counterintuitive? I mean, the imminent threat comes up instantly. Now, he has the right to have the firearm when the imminent threat arises, but he doesn't have the right to bring it with him to the place where the imminent threat arises.
Your Honor, I guess I would say that as a convict, I would draw a distinction between a convicted felon and, to use the phrase...
But the statute or the cases don't draw that distinction.
Yes, they do, Your Honor, very clearly. I beg to differ with all due respect.
Well, they say he has the right to continue to bear arms in protection of life, liberty, and property. Does it not? I mean, that's what Blue says.
And it says in order to do that, you have to read PAPO and peri materia with the choice of evil statute. And choice of evils requires that there be an emergency situation which makes it necessary to avoid the imminent injury. Those cases, Your Honor, I think if I might, as opposed to somewhat, PAPO in this court, most recently in the Montez case, and I believe Judge Furman was on that panel, reiterated the purpose of the PAPO statute. It is to keep to restrict the possession, limit, I believe is the word they use, limit the possession of weapons from convicted felons who have because they have demonstrated an unfitness to possess those weapons. That's the purpose of the PAPO statute. It's been upheld as constitutional. That purpose has been reiterated by the Colorado Court of Appeals. There are two Supreme Court cases that are cited in that passage in Montez that I'm referring to, and it's in the reply brief. So unlike the average citizen or someone who does not have a felony conviction, that person could possess the weapon ahead of time, as you're saying, keep, because they're not subject to the PAPO statute. And our position is that absent that imminent threat, the possession by a convicted felon is not constitutionally protected. That's Barger, and that's Barger interpreting Ford.
Let me just see if I can track what you're saying. Once there is a threat that's imminent, at that point, the convicted felon could go retrieve a firearm?
Yes.
And not before?
Yes. That's the distinction between a convicted felon. Because if not, Your Honor, then basically, I see my time. I'll take.
Go ahead, ma'am. Go ahead and stop the clock and finish your answer.
If not, and these are the federal cases make this eminently clear, if not, a convicted felon could carry that weapon indefinitely, saying, I have it today because I may need to defend tomorrow or next week because so-and-so, because of this, because of that. And that would make basically our PALPO statute a dead letter, to borrow from the famous quote from the Perez case. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
If we run you over time, we'll give you some extra time also. But you need not use it all.
That's true. Possible. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Susan Martin. My registration number is 33994, which is fairly new, but I do have 10 years of experience in Kansas, so I'm not completely new. May it please the court, our argument is that the appellant is trying to take you places that are way beyond the issues of this particular case. They're trying to drive you into the issue of imminence and the definition of imminence, way beyond whether or not what they claim is that as a matter of law, the instruction that was relied on by the trial court was an inaccurate or a misstatement of the law. It's our position that the instruction relied on upon the court is a perfect statement of the law as applied by both Blue, Ford, and Barger, as well as comports with the Supreme Court Committee suggested purpose of possession instruction that we believe is persuasive authority at the very least. Issues as to imminence, which is where the appellant is trying to drive the court, are issues that are more accurately taken up under the context of the affirmative defenses of choice of evils, defense of property, defense of person, and they're unrelated to what was going on in this particular case and what the court was focused on. The court in this particular case, it was a bench trial. I was the trial attorney, and we were suggesting to the court that there was an affirmative defense based on the Ford case. Court accepted that, and in fact, in its findings, in the transcripts, the court specifically finds that the people failed to sustain their burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not act in self-defense. The apparent buyer of their argument wants to focus on Blue, which is an entirely different matter. The Blue case was a question of whether or not the PALPO statute was even constitutional. In Blue, they made a finding that the statute was constitutional, even if it lacked something as far as specificity in every single word. And the court went into the issue that it's not required that they define every single word in the statute. And basically, in Blue, they said you must read this statute in conjunction with, in peri materia, with the other affirmative defenses and the issues related to the case. What Blue did not do, it did not mandate that choice of evils must be applied to every single PALPO case. What it was saying is that if there's any insufficiency in the statute, that you must read all of the instructions together, which is a very common sense approach to the case. Our position is that choice of evils have nothing to do with our case. And the court agreed. It said that if it was considering choice of evils, it wouldn't give the instruction.
So you're saying that under Blue, had you raised a choice of evils defense, that might require them to be read together, but you did not raise it.
We did not raise it. We specifically in the transcript said that we were not proceeding under the choice of evil statute. It wasn't a situation where there was an escape from jail and we were trying to claim some sort of separate emergency. Our situation, based on the facts of the case, which were presented in several different ways, only suggested that the defense was for the person, basically self-defense. And the court agreed, saying that the people had failed to disprove self-defense. It spends quite a bit of time talking about how choice of evils doesn't apply, but we believe that the state has gone
beyond the facts of the case by implying that choice of evils must apply in every single affirmative defense situation, which clearly it does not. I mean, affirmative defenses are defined by the legislature and basically tailored by the courts to apply in separate situations. And in this case, choice of evils had nothing to do with it. That's where we believe that the people are sort of misdirecting the court by implying that choice of evils has to apply this case. What I believe the court did in its application of the instruction that is based on the purpose of possession is that the court basically took self-defense in the instruction and its understanding of it, took the proffered instruction as to the purpose of possession, and concluded that the state had failed to disprove self-defense, which is completely separate from any issues as to eminence or anything related to that. Ford, unlike Blue, where the situation was the defense was attempting to claim that the Palpo statute was unconstitutional, Ford is much more narrow and on point with this case, where it says that a statutory right cannot nullify a constitutional right, which has been basically is the same sort of proposition that's in Barger and most of the other cases that are cited. Barger, we believe, is different because in Barger, the court found that there was insufficient evidence to support the giving of the affirmative defense, which is completely different than this situation. The court accepted not only the instruction that was proffered, even though the court tailored it to its understanding of the law, the court also made a finding that that there was self-defense, there had been evidence presented of self-defense, and found that the people had failed to disprove it, which is the appropriate way to apply an affirmative defense. So our position is basically that we don't need to go into all of these other issues because the premise of the people that the instruction was clearly erroneous as a matter of law is basically not supported.
You say instruction, but no instructions were ever given. The court was just using the instructions to glean the law.
Initially, the state and the defense submitted instructions to the court, and in there we had an instruction that was based on People v. Ford raising the affirmative defense that it was appropriate to give an affirmative defense when there's an issue of constitutional magnitude. And the court, in its remarks, when it was determining what instructions to follow, basically cited to its modification. In other words, it was going to take out the inclusion of in defense of another person and basically talked about the submitted instructions, which were the Supreme Court's recommended instructions for the purpose of possession. Which the reason I think that these things should not be all joined together, because there is a distinction to be made between the action of self-defense when there's force encountered, and the question is whether the force can be justified. And that it's a very different situation in Ford where the court or the jury is questioning the issue of what is the purpose of possession, which I think makes it very ripe for its own affirmative defense that is unrelated to other issues of self-defense. I don't think that the people would suggest that the court somehow misinformed itself about affirmative defenses, burdens of proof. It was merely applying the affirmative defense that's set out in Ford. And in its case, it's in distinction from Barger because the court did find that there was sufficient support to consider the affirmative defense as to the purpose of possession.
Ms. Martin, let's talk about the Barger case a little bit. My understanding is that Ms. Buchalter is saying that Barger does exemplify the limit on the defense by saying you need to have a threat. Do you agree with that there needs to be a threat?
Well, I think that to me, the distinction in Barger was that it never really got to the issue of the details of the instruction, because the Barger court said that the defendant had failed to produce sufficient evidence to support the affirmative defense. So in other words, the court said basically that the defendant, as a matter of law, had failed to present evidence that were sufficient, that would rise to the level that would justify a felon in use of in possession of a weapon. So I don't think the Barger court basically sets out and relies on Ford, saying that in fact there is an affirmative defense that is available, that it went further to say that in this particular case, in Barger, there are not sufficient facts to support an affirmative defense. So our position is Barger is a misapplication of the law, because it doesn't render Ford invalid. It doesn't modify it in any particular way. It basically sets out the same proposition that there is an affirmative defense that is available. But in that case, there wasn't facts that supported it. In our particular case, we had affidavits that were accepted. Basically, there was a waiver of some of the foundational requirements, but the court accepted a statement from the girlfriend and also had statements of the defendant that basically set out that initially and from the very beginning to the police and everyone else, the defendant said that the purpose of possession was self-defense. So we would say that that's a distinction in Barker.
Did he designate what he needed a defense against?
Yes. The threat was that a boyfriend, the night before, the boyfriend, Matt, they had come across each other and that he had in the past and had continued to threaten both the girlfriend and the defendant. And the facts of our case were a little bit different because it was our position that it really wasn't even the defendant's weapon. It was a taser that was in the console of the car, and the female had been arrested. Police came back to the car, made contact with my client, and he basically consented to a search of himself and informed them there's a taser in the console of the car. And the reason it's there is because my girlfriend and I have been threatened. And it was the most recent contact with the boyfriend had been the night before. So the court accepted the affidavit, accepted the defendant's statements, determined that the affirmative defense based on Blue was appropriate, and applied it accurately based on Blue. Issues as relate to sufficiency of the evidence and the court's understanding of other affirmative defenses and self-defense, those are issues that the court didn't specifically set out, doesn't have to go step by step through its thought process. But the court basically was very clear that the state failed to meet their burden of disproving the affirmative defense, which makes us believe that, you know, we're not here to clarify issues of imminence. We're not here to clarify the self-defense instructions, and we're not here.
At any point, did the court say that what their burden was? I mean, what they had to disprove?
Yeah, the court basically in the transcript says that he was basically that the people had failed to disprove self-defense. So in other words, the court basically didn't craft instructions for itself to read, basically relied on the affirmative defenses, relied on the issues of self-defense, found that choice of evils did not apply, but found that there was an equal, separate affirmative defense of, I mean, it's a very narrow situation where a defendant would be able to use this as a defense. First of all, there has to be credible evidence that there was a threat and all the issues that are related to self-defense, imminence. But I think that our position is that the people are really desiring a more specific definition of imminence that's more comports with the federal cases that it sets out in its brief.
I read their argument as saying that choice of evils is sort of a gloss over this defense, that you have to prove choice of evils,
which I believe is it's not an illogical conclusion based on Blue that choice of evils somehow applies to every single affirmative defense, which it does not. Our position is choice of evils is an affirmative defense, as is self-defense, as is a number of other defenses, affirmative defenses. So the idea that because as to the issue in Blue, the issue is choice of evils versus the right to bear arms, and then the court concluded that the police power is allowed and that but it cannot nullify a constitutional right. In that case, choice of evils was applicable. In our case, it is not, and it is not required that you read choice of evils in order to apply the facts of self-defense.
So my understanding of what you're saying is there may be more than one type of affirmative defense to PAUPO, one of which might be choice of evils, another of which might be the constitutional
right
protection.
And the only reason that the instruction that was tendered and the instruction that was drafted by the committee, which is what was used basically and discussed, that specifically relates to the affirmative defense, a very narrow situation of the purpose of possession, which is completely different than the actual application of force where there's been something that's trying to be justified. The court in Ford says, and Blue, said that there is a constitutional right to defend oneself, one property, and that that is completely separate from choice of evils. It is an affirmative defense, but it's an affirmative defense that is very narrow, that is unrelated to choice of evils, that is unrelated to voluntary intoxication and all the other affirmative defenses that are available to the defense.
So is it your position then with the constitutional defense that there has to be a presence of harm or presence of threat in order to invoke it?
I believe there is. I believe that basically that the self-defense instructions must be read in context with the affirmative defense. In other words, if this had gone to a trial, a jury trial, the jury would have been instructed not only of the affirmative defense of purpose of possession, but also would have, as a sub-classification, been advised of self-defense and the elements that are required by self-defense. In this particular case, it's our position that the court did not mislead itself, that it basically concluded that choice of evils didn't apply, that self-defense did apply, and accurately applied the facts of that to the case.
Would you agree that had the police contacted your client and he said there is a taser in the glove box of the car, he pulls out his handy dandy copy of the Colorado Constitution, opens it up and says, in accordance to Article 1 so and so, I have a right to carry it in protection of life, liberty, and property, that would not be an affirmative defense without some sort of additional evidence that he's under some threat?
Yes, I agree with that. That basically, in other words, and I believe the court also considered that when applying the law in this particular case, that the court believed that there would have been sufficient evidence presented by the defendant and also by the people that supported the issue of self-defense, and that self-defense was an appropriate subclassification because it basically the court applied that there was this affirmative defense of the purpose of possession and then further found the facts as to the issue of self-defense and determined that the state had failed to disprove the self-defense issue, which I believe is a completely separate issue than addressing this case through choice of evils, because they're very separate affirmative defenses that really are not necessarily related by any requirement or legal requirement that they are related together. Thank you.
There are 4 minutes and 50 seconds, counsel.
Your Honor, I think the defense here has conceded the essential point in this case, and that is that there is a requirement for the presence of a threat or an imminent threat under the constitutional right to bear arms.
She claims there is one here. I mean, mine was more of a hypothetical question. It doesn't seem to me she's conceding anything.
Because
she says there was a self-defense concern here that was given.
Your Honor, there wasn't. The only instruction that the court relied on, and he marked it as an exhibit, was the affirmative defense. It's marked, it's in the record. And he said, this is what I'm relying on, and I want to mark it as an exhibit. And it wasn't the classic self-defense instruction. The only one he relied on, he was very clear in the record, it's an affirmative defense to the crime of palpo that the defendant possessed the weapon for the purpose of defending his home, person, or property. That's under the constitutional provision, not the separate self-defense statutory instruction. So that was not what the court relied on, very clearly. And the pivotal issue in this case, factually, there was no evidence of an imminent threat at the time the defendant possessed this weapon in the car when he was arrested. He testified to the same. He said...
Well, the boyfriend wasn't standing there pointing a gun at him.
He wasn't.
On that part, I would agree with you, but the testimony, apparently uncontradicted, is that indeed the former boyfriend had threatened both himself and his girlfriend.
Yes, Your Honor, but the cases we have cited over and over, and Barger would support this, is that a prior threat is not sufficient. In Barger, the defendant had encounters with a motorcycle gang. He'd been threatened, and that's why he carried the weapon. And this court said that's insufficient because there has to be an imminent threat at the time of the illegal possession. And there wasn't here, Your Honor. The defendant testified here under oath that he did not see the boyfriend, the ex-boyfriend, Matt, that day, that he was not anywhere in the Safeway parking lot, that he didn't see him there, and that he had no fear of that boyfriend at that time. There was no imminent threat. And the issue that counsel argued...
But that gets me back to my main concern. It's like asking a fireman, telling a fireman he can't carry a fire extinguisher. And then when he encounters a fire, he can't put out the fire because you told him he can't carry a fire extinguisher.
Your Honor, he's not a convicted felon, hopefully.
The Constitution, I think, looks beyond the fact that he's a convicted felon.
Your Honor, I would...
And I don't happen to agree with you that the mere fact that someone's convicted of forgery or some other totally peaceful crime disqualifies them from carrying a firearm necessarily.
Your Honor, that's what the Palpo statute says.
I know that's what the Palpo said. But you said it disqualified them because of their character. It doesn't disqualify them because of their character. It may disqualify them under the statute, but that's a different matter.
Your Honor, I was referencing the Montez court case in which this court stated that. So I appreciate the court's comments. I want to make one thing very clear here. The precise issue here was whether an imminent threat. It was not a sideline. If you look at that closing argument, defense counsel argued there was no evidence that there was no requirement that there be an imminent threat as a part of this affirmative defense instruction. And the trial deputy argued vigorously the other way. And that was the issue here. And that was the issue in Barger. And that's why this case is directly controlled by Barger, Your Honor. There is no imminent threat. The fact that he saw the boyfriend the night before doesn't mean anything. And in fact, he testified there was no threat to him the night before from the boyfriend. So that was not contested. What was contested was, what are the essential elements of the instruction? And under this instruction that the trial court marked as an exhibit, and he said he wanted guidance from the appellate courts on this. That's why he made the record that he made.
Didn't the trial court in the end say you failed to disprove the affirmative defense?
Yes, Your Honor, but that's our point. With this instruction, it puts an impossible burden on the prosecution to disprove it, because a defendant can say, I've got this weapon today because I think I'm going to need it next week. And that completely eviscerates the Palpo statute that says, no, you may not, as a convicted felon, possess that weapon. Absent the active act of defending person, home, or property. I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for their arguments and briefs. The case will be deemed submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. We're now ready to hear Hopkins versus Out of Africa as soon as counsel is ready.